It's time for the Cincinnati Reds, brought to you by the Burger Brewing Company. And now, here's baseball.
Well, good evening, everyone, and this is Wade Hoyt at Crosley Field.
Before there was Great American Ballpark, even before Riverfront Stadium, there stood a classic baseball park in Cincinnati's West End that faithfully served as the team's home for 58 years, 2 months, and 13 days. It cost $225,000 to build what was first known as Redland Field when it opened in 1912. When inventor and industrialist Powell Crosley Jr. became involved with the team, the name was changed to Crosley Field in 1934. By the time the last game was played there in the summer of 1970, the ballpark had witnessed lots of baseball history and created lots of memories for Reds fans. Good evening, I'm Mark Haney, and this is Cincinnati Baseball, Crosley Field. Join us for a nostalgic trip down memory lane and a look at one of the enduring symbols of baseball in the Queen City. The recording you're about to hear is a tribute to former Reds owner Powell Crosley Jr., made at Johnette's studio in Richmond in 1923. It's officially anonymous, but the speaker may be J. Walter DeVoe, a prominent Masonic musician who worked in Cincinnati at the time. This recording is followed by Crosley expert Michael Banks, co-author of the book Crosley.
During that first interview with Powell Crosley Jr., president of the Crosley Radio Corporation and the biggest single figure in radio today, you may come to some conclusions in your analysis of his personality, watching him stride nervously up and down, long legs and arms swinging, brows twisted and pulled down over penetrating dark eyes that look into your eyes, searching for your game before he plays his. You may go away with a score of mental snapshots of that enormously tall head, of that jaw and those lips relaxed in unrestrained laughter or clenched in relentless determination, of those restless feet, those twitching fingers. You may even find out something of his mentality and his character, but you will never completely appreciate the genius of Powell Crosley Jr. until you have come to know him thoroughly, see him in a thousand moods, observe his secret generosity, his reckless audacity, his persistent courage, his constant enthusiasm, his satanic tenacity, his complete naturalness, his extraordinary intelligence, and his phenomenal capacity for character development. During the past 2 years, he has acquired great wealth and established himself in the world of American affairs. Yet the growth of his business has not kept pace with the development of his character. He has absorbed ideas, consulted experts, traveled from metropolis to metropolis, and studied himself and his own possibilities with as much care and honesty as he has the Crosley Radio Corporation. And the result is that instead of becoming conceited, he has become more liberal. He is more diplomatic with his competitors, more generous with his associates, more loyal than ever to his friends, and more democratic, much more democratic, with humanity at large. His life is just beginning. His possibilities are gigantic. Product of the Middle West, American through and through, he is typical of that race of brainy, energetic, clean-minded men destined to make the greatest mark in history that mankind has ever known.
By the time the opportunity came for Powell Crosley Jr. to get into the Reds organization, Powell was a multimillionaire. He had a company that he had taken public, Crosley Radio Corporation, and Crosley Broadcasting, WLW, WSAI by then as well. And he was approached by a consortium of people who, well, mainly represented the bank who had taken over the Reds organization, Larry McPhail being the point man here. And the previous owner, oddly enough, was in auto accessories as well, if it had gone broke. And McPhail appealed to Powell's vanity, telling him, "You're the only person who could do this. You're a well-known baseball fan, especially a fan of the Reds. You love baseball. You pitched as a child. You pitched with the College Hill Belmonts. You even did some pitching for the University of Cincinnati. And think what a civic hero you would be." And who knows, maybe he said something like it, "You can get into any game you want free." So Powell agreed. Contracts were signed. He took a partial interest in the Cincinnati Reds. He spent money upgrading the field. At some point, he demanded that Redlands Field be changed to Crosley Field. So Crosley Field it was, and any other name sounds weird to me. Even today, Great American Ballpark, it's Crosley Field. They should have kept the name down the line. And it was a classic ballpark, just like Camden Yards and so many of the other ones. It was eventually too small. They had parking problems. Powell pulled a little scam where he pretended like he would take the Reds out of Cincinnati if Cincinnati didn't establish more parking. But that's all it was, as a scam, but it worked. It was a nice trick. And there, as head of the Reds, and we've kind of leaped over his radio business and his broadcast business, there's some more jobs to add in there. Wearing a lot of hats, he was at the same time. Powell never really left the Reds until he died. He kept his full investment in it. I should add something to what I said earlier. He took a partial interest. Eventually, he bought the whole thing, bought all the other shares from everyone else who was involved, and he established a foundation for the Reds. And it was tied in with this will, and one of the stipulations was that the Reds would always stay in Cincinnati. Lewis, his brother, his daughter Paige, and a couple of other people, maybe Gabe Paul, were trustees. They were more or less in charge of things, overseeing things, but Powell had left Lewis, his brother, whom he trusted the most, as the main guy in charge of things. For a time, Powell's grandson by Paige, Lou, worked there in various capacities. He left in the 1960s. He thought he was going to have the job eventually running the club, but found out otherwise and left. So we have to say that Powell Crosley Jr. never really left the Reds, and the Reds never really forgot him.
John Arardi covers the Reds for the Cincinnati Inquirer and also has written extensively about the team's history.
At Union Terminal, where the first ballpark was, that was the Union Grounds for the 1869 Red Stockings. And then they later moved around town a couple different times, but in 1894, they settled over on the West End at League Park, and in 1902, that became the Palace of the Fans, perhaps Cincinnati's most elegant ballpark. And then by 1912, they had built Redland Field, which is on the exact location Crosley Field was located, which was filling in Market. There were so many people living on the West End, there was actually space there for a beautiful ballpark. When they originally built it, it was an old brickyard, and the famous Crosley Field Terrace, which was the upslope of ground in left field, which actually served as a warning track and tripped up many a left fielder, was the downslope of ground from York Street down into the brickyard. They left it there, they put up a fence just behind it, and that became what is known as the Terrace. And as I say, guys like Willie Mays, Joe DiMaggio, even Babe Ruth tripped out there, much to their chagrin. Frank Robinson said, he said it was a warning track, but you had to actually climb up it and climb down it. And we're talking about a slope of ground that probably went up about 4 feet over the space of maybe 5 or 6 feet from the level playing field up to the fence, and of course York Street behind. So it was a sort of dangerous, if you will, but it was also unique, and that's what I think a lot of people remember about Crosley Field, is the so-called terrace. The Sun and Moon Deck, they've been replicated at the new ballpark, Great American Ballpark, but what they were was the right field bleachers, basically. What was unique about them was very gentle slope of seats, had the fans very close to the right fielder and, for that matter, the center fielder. Obviously, the moon deck part came into play when the lights came in 1935 and thereafter they began playing night baseball. Then the sun deck became the moon deck. Favorite place for fans to hang out. Just a really cool place to be.
On May 24, 1935, President Franklin Roosevelt threw a switch at the White House, turning on the lights at Crosley Field for professional baseball's first night game. Here's legendary baseball announcer Red Barber.
MacPhail had a terrible time getting permission in the National League. He wanted permission to play seven night games, one with each of the other opposing ball clubs. There were then eight teams in the league. And he was getting nowhere in the National League until he went to Chicago and talked to Judge Landis, baseball's first commissioner. And Landis believed MacPhail's presentation. Cincinnati had been a bankrupt ball club, and Landis knew that the Reds had to do something to increase attendance. The Depression was on. It was a very desperate situation. MacPhail was a very persuasive man. And also, MacPhail had had experience with lights at Columbus in the American Association. So Landis put behind the scenes the pressure on the other National League teams and said, for goodness sake, let this man go ahead and try and get this ball club out of the hands of the bank. And that really had more to do with it than anything else.
There were Doubting Thomases, an army of them, club owners, who said baseball is meant to be played in the daytime, in the sun. It's wrong to play it at night. Also, it'll be uncomfortable for the fans at night. Also, the illumination won't be good, etc.
The lighting was so good that that was the story of the first night game, over and above the fact that it was a very beautifully played ball game. No one expected, unless it was MacPhail, no one expected the brilliance of the lights. There were no shadows on the field. You see, people were thinking in terms of the light installations in the few years before in various minor league parks where the lights were not good because one of the minor league owners of these teams didn't have the money to do it. But MacPhail went to General Electric, and they sent their engineers in, and then MacPhail always knew where to get the best advice. There was a brilliant young engineer at the Crosley Radio Corporation, Joe Chambers, who had graduated at Clemson. Chambers, out of his own mind, had devised the plans and built the half a million watt experimental transmitter for the Crosley Radio Corporation. He was some engineer. So Joe Chambers guided MacPhail and his relations step by step with General Electric. And when those lights came on, that was the story, and it's still been the story.
In 1937, when the big flood hit, which inundated so much of Cincinnati, there are pictures of a couple of Reds ball players in a rowboat rowing across the infield. The water is obviously 5 or 6 feet deep there because of its depth, if you will. As I say, a former brickyard was actually below street level. You can imagine how quickly that would have flooded. And there were serious problems there. They had their doubts about even getting, I think, opening day 1937 in. But if memory serves, in my reading the history books, they did get it in, but they had to really squeegee out the dugouts. It was a tough day at Crosley Field on opening day 1937. Opening day was one of those opportunities where they would sell more seats than they had, so they would rope off the outfield in front of the fence and let the fans sit there. In fact, Jim Greengrass, I believe, hit four doubles in 1954, and he told me that three of them were legitimate shots, but one bounced in. Of course, once the ball bounces in to the fans, it becomes a ground rule double. He claims he would have had three doubles anyway. The fourth one was a gift. When it first began, it was one of the biggest ballparks in baseball. It was just huge, well over 400 feet, even to right field. It was, I think, a long time before anybody even hit the ball out of the ballpark there. Later on, they shortened it, put up the so-called go run, which was built to shorten the right field home run area. But as Joe Nuxall once told me, he said, they built that so Tech Lazuski could wind up hitting more home runs there. He said what happened was Richie Ashburn of the Phillies hit a ton of cheap home runs in the right field off of me. So he wasn't too happy about the goat run. But pitchers, when the ballpark became smaller, I think in the 50s particularly, center field was only, I think it was measured at 390-something, 390 feet something. And Joe Nuxall and the pitchers took a tape measure from home plate. They measured it to dead center field and was 383 feet, by far the shortest center field in the major league. So the pitchers were not too happy about the intimacy of the ballpark. The fans were, but not the Reds pitchers in particular.
The distinctive voice of Reds pitcher and eventually Reds broadcaster Joe Nuxall, born July 30th, 1928. Sadly, the old left-hander passed away in 2007.
I'm nervous, and the first batter, and I think it was Emil Vervin, but I'm not sure. But nevertheless, he grounded out to short. And the second batter up, I go 3-2 on him, and I walk him. The third batter up, he pops out to short. The fourth batter, I got him 0-2. No balls, two strikes. And now I realize where I am at. I'm not at Wilson Junior High, and I don't like to use profanity, but all hell broke loose. And from that point on, I walked four more batters. They got two hits through two wild pitches, and five earned runs.
His son, Phil, has lots of fond memories of Crosley Field and his dad's years there.
Well, you know, I was trying to think the other day of my earliest memory, and it actually involves taking the bus with my mom and our next-door neighbors from Hamilton. It was the Lindenwald area of Hamilton, all the way downtown to Cincinnati, which was a big deal back then, got all dressed up. And I remember we went to either the Cricket or Wiggins for lunch. And then that evening we went to I think it was Peter Pan on Ice. And that's my first memory. And then probably Hamilton Nights. They would have Hamilton Night every year. And the one I remember the most was when they honored Dad. And I was 4 years old, I believe. They had a motorcade or a bus caravan from Hamilton that went all the way up Hamilton Avenue to Crosley Field. And I think there was like over 40 buses filled with Hamiltonians. And, you know, as a four-year-old, I was a little taken aback by all of this because I didn't understand what was going on. And we were in this, at the time, this big fancy station wagon with the head of the caravan, which nowadays probably would be some big limo. And when we got to Crosley, they had this big ceremony, and they presented Dad with the key to the city. And we've got this photograph of Dad holding me in his arms, and I've got my little Reds baseball uniform on. And it was Mom, Grandpa, and Grandma. They gave him a stove. I think he even got a car. But it was really kind of frightening, because I just didn't understand what was going on. But that was when it dawned on me, oh my gosh, Dad's kind of revered around here. He was just Dad to me.
There's a long drive into center field. That ball can't be cut. It might be out of here. It's off the boards. Rose around second. Now he's around third. And he's going to score easy, and we win. We have won the ball game. Yes, sir, my first win.
Crosley Field was like my playground for my brother Kim and I. We would, in the summertime, when the Reds were playing at home, we had dinner, I think it was either 3 or 3:30 in the afternoon. That was dinner, because Dad had to get to the ballpark for batting practice before the game, and Kim and I would go down with him. We would pick up Frank McCormick. Frank McCormick was an announcer, I think at that time. Yeah, he was in the booth. He was from New York, and he stayed with his aunt, I believe, in Fairfield, in this big old farmhouse. They had this big cow named Cherry. But we would pick Frank up, and, you know, I didn't know any different. He was just somebody Dad worked with. We'd go down to the ballpark. My brother would immediately wait for batting practice, and he would toss the ball with all the biggies. And I would wait for Ronnie Dale, the organist. That was my thrill, was waiting for Ronnie Dale to come out and start practicing on the Hammond X100 organ, which is why I took organ lessons, because I wanted to be Ronnie Dale. I wanted to play the organ at the ballpark. And he actually would let me play the organ after some games. I remember the top keyboard was lit up, I think, in green. The keys were lit up green and the bottom red. And I was just mesmerized. So much so that I imitated him. I memorized his whole routine. He had this routine he would play, of course, the Mexican hat dance during seventh inning stretch, and of course take me out the ball game. That's a given. And then at the end of the game, he always played Good Night Ladies. And when I eventually got the Hammond X100 organ, I had to have the same one, of course, I would play his whole routine by ear. I couldn't read. I played by ear because of Ronnie Dale. And then there's Wilma the Hot Dog Lady. In addition to waiting for Ronnie Dale, I would go underneath the grandstands. And, you know, you go underneath the grandstands. It was just like another world. And I would wait for those steel partitions that would roll up with the concessions. And when they would roll them up, that means they were open. And I would wait for Wilma. I thought she was the most beautiful woman in the world. She had this jet black hair, painted on real thin eyebrows. But Wilma just thought I was cutest thing on earth, and she would give me free hot dogs. And that meant more to me than any famous, you know, Mickey Mantle could come walking in, and I'm like, oh, hi, Mickey, you know, but give me that hot dog. Let me talk to Wilma. Many, many memories. Wally Post, Gus Bell, Clue, of course, big Clue. It was Bertie Tebbets, Ed Bailey. It was quite a family affair, quite the time. And I got to know a lot of the other families after the games because there was a certain area at Crosley Field where we would wait for our dads or spouse, whatever, to come out of the clubhouse. The clubhouse was very secluded at Crosley. I mean, it was really off the beaten path, which came in handy when the Beatles were there. Because when the Beatles were there, the first night was rained out, and they actually didn't perform the concert until the next day. But I went down there with some friends. I was in junior high school at the time. And, of course, I wasn't interested in photography, so I didn't take a camera or anything. But I kind of surmised where the Beatles would be hanging out before or after the concert. And I thought, I bet they're going to hold them up in the clubhouse. And not a lot of people knew where the clubhouse was. So I told my friends, I said, follow me. So this was before the concert started. I take them all the way around the cavernous area to the clubhouse, and there was a ramp, and it was separated by these steel bars as you went up the ramp to keep, I don't say people away, but for security reasons. And as soon as we got there, here come the Beatles out of the clubhouse, down the ramp. I mean, I'm like 6 inches away from the Beatles. Well, of course, everybody I was with, all the girls are screaming at the top of their lungs. And I just kind of stood there like, there's the Beatles in there. I could touch them if I wanted to. Yeah, so that kind of came in handy, knowing where the clubhouse was.
It was, I think it was 328 down the left field line, a little bigger than that down the right field line. And actually, the deepest part of the ballpark, if memory serves, I can't remember if it was left center or right center. I think it might have been right center. It was actually a little bit longer than the three they measured it. So, yeah, very asymmetrical ballpark. And I think that quirkiness is its charm because it was hard to play the balls off the wall in certain places. You had to be a veteran Reds outfield in order to know the bounces out there. And I think from what I've read, and obviously reading a lot of accounts from managers and players, particularly in the 50s, when I'm most familiar with, they felt it was the most intimate ballpark in all of the major leagues. Mattie Schwab was the groundskeeper, and a couple of Schwabs followed him generationally in that chain. But the scoreboard people probably have seen in pictures, and one of Johnny Vandermeer's no-hitters was a shorter scoreboard. Still very beautiful, but sometime later, I think it was in the early 50s perhaps, they put up a bigger scoreboard. In fact, Frank Robinson was telling me, in fact, I'm going to say it was more like the late 50s, maybe early 60s, they put up a bigger scoreboard. And Frank said that scoreboard was about 5 stories high and robbed him of many a home run. But his other point to me was, but center field was shorter than most ballparks, so I hit more home runs to center field than I could anywhere else. So he basically said, what one thing taketh away, the other one giveth. So it was a beautiful scoreboard, but much to Frank Robinson's chagrin, cost him a lot of home runs. I've heard stories, and this occurred, I think it might have been in the 50s. One guy wound up getting locked in the scoreboard overnight. And what that told me was there was only one guy operating that scoreboard. Had there been two, they probably would have figured a way to get out of there. But with just one guy in there, it made for a long night. I think there was a door leading into that scoreboard from left center field, if memory serves. And there were some jokes played on some ball players opening that door and pushing them in and that sort of thing. It was just a unique operation out there.
Jim was a peanut man, sold peanuts on a peanut stand. Want a bag of peanuts? Jim would shout as he drove his peanut stand about. He's on the road again, sure as you're born on the road again. Oh, there he goes, Peanut Jim, the peanut man, drove a Cadillac peanut stand. Peanut Jim wore a black top hat, ragged tux with tails in the back. Kept his peanut prices low while he always kept his head held high. You know he's on the road again, sure as you're born on the road again. There he goes, Peanut Jim, the peanut man, drove a Cadillac peanut stand. Crosley Field, over the Rhine, spent a bridge on the Ohio side. Sold peanuts wherever he could. The whole Queen City never smelled so good. He's on the road again, sure as you're born on the road again. Oh, there he goes, Peanut Jim, the peanut man, drove a Cadillac peanut stand. When the new ballpark come to town, Peanut Jim got pushed around. We want peanut prices up, you sell too low, so pack on up. He's on the road again, sure as you're born on the road again. Oh, there he goes, Peanut Jim, the peanut man, drove a Cadillac peanut stand. Old, run down and beat, but at 91 still on his feet. I'll sell my peanuts where I like. I'm the peanut man, you take the hike. He's on the road again, sure as you're born on the road again. Oh, there he goes, Peanut Jim, the peanut man, drove a Cadillac peanut stand. Peanut Jim's now dead and gone, but the peanut man will long live on. Jim's out there somewhere, I know, with his head up high and his price down low. He's on the road again, sure as you're born on the road again. Oh, there he goes, Peanut Jim, the peanut man, drove a Cadillac peanut stand. He's on the road again, sure as you're born on the road again. Oh, there he goes, Peanut Jim, the peanut man, drove a Cadillac peanut stand.
Over the Rhine personality, Jim Tarbell talks about one of his favorite characters from the Crosley Field days.
Well, Jim Shelton, or otherwise known as Peanut Jim Shelton, I think most people would know him that way, although I've run into a number of people that grew up with him in West End, and they just call him Jim Shelton. But the first time I met him unofficially was when I went to the ballpark as a kid, and I couldn't tell you the date or the time or my exact age. I would guess maybe about 11, at the old Crosley Field. He was the peanut vendor there, and he was right near the front door. He was a tall man. He would be over 100 now, so that was 50 years ago. And he would be 6 feet, a little taller, which was tall at that time, and looked all the taller because he had a top hat on, top hat and tails. And he's a very handsome man, you know, bronze skin, thin, and he cut a really fine figure, and particularly with the top hat and tails on, and he's roasting his peanuts. Well, you couldn't help but notice him. And it turns out that his peanuts were not very good. They were usually a little bit on the burnt side. But it didn't make any difference. You know, you had to buy peanuts from this man because of how he presented himself. He was part of the flavor of going to the ballpark. He was right at the front door. That's my memory of him as a child, as a young kid. He wasn't exactly the most engaging or outgoing. He looked always looked fairly serious. But if he cracked a little bit of a smile, it was a big deal because of what all else went with it. But I remember as being fairly serious. So that carried with me through my youth. And then when Crosley Field was closed, unfortunately, they moved the ballpark down to the riverfront. He went with it. It's important to point out that for me, it was kind of a defining moment in our humanitarianism in Cincinnati that he was not invited to come up on the plaza and be part of the immediate campus surrounding the ballpark at the riverfront, which is where he had been historically and where you would expect him to be. Instead, he was remanded to the sidewalk down below. That's a whole level, another world, really, a whole level below the ballpark. And I think it was just at that time the Reds' interest in keeping all the economy inside their campus. But anyway, he continued to be a fixture there. Just the juxtaposition of him and the ballpark wasn't the same, so it wasn't quite the same experience. And you didn't have the romance of Crosley Field either, or West End. I mean, you were in a neighborhood when you were at Crosley Field. The ballpark's on the river kind of by itself. I had all these memories of him as a kid, and fast forward to the present, that would be a couple of decades ago. I'm walking in the Finley Market Parade, the opening day parade for the beginning of the baseball season. I owned Grammer's Restaurant at the time, which was a big part of the history of Over the Rhine, and I thought it was important for Grammer's to be represented in the parade. And so I was walking in the parade with, and I happened to have a top hat and tails myself from some time ago, which I bought at a thrift store in Over the Rhine. It's because it was, I loved that look, and it was a great set of clothes, and it fit me, and the price was right. And so I was always looking for an opportunity to wear that outfit and celebrate that look. So I'm walking in the parade with a sign saying, "Eat at Grammer's," essentially. And I'm thinking, this is really kind of short of the mark. Doesn't have any real character to it, number one. Number two, I kept thinking about him because I had been other places, other times wearing the top hat and tails. Inevitably or invariably, folks would mention Peanut Jim. I thought, I wonder if this could be an opportunity to honor him and his history. And I coincidentally found a peanut cart from a friend in Northside, Walt, at the Fifth Amendment. He's now deceased, as is Peanut Jim, by the way. He died in 1989, and he was about that age. He was a little younger than that, I guess, when he died. Still doing Peanuts pretty much until the time he died. And I hasten to mention that somewhere along the way, I don't know exactly, maybe 10 years before he died, he had one leg amputated. Well, it was his right leg amputated. It was probably because of standing up all those years and having gotten bad circulation from that. In any event, it was a full leg amputation, and he continued to go to the ballpark every day, every game, and sell peanuts. So I found the peanut cart, and that became the float in the parade, was myself recalling the memory of Peanut Jim with my top hat and tails, and then the peanut cart, and then carrying a banner acknowledging him and his birth and death dates. And then coincidentally, Jeff Wehmeyer, who's a friend of mine whose father was a pitcher with the Reds, Herman Wehmeyer, otherwise known as Herman the German Wehmeyer from the West Side, pitched for the Reds in the late 40s, early 50s. And Jeff had his road uniform, which is one of those beautiful classic all-wool uniforms, and it fit me. Well, that's another matter. It fit Jeff, too. And Jeff, I asked him if he would walk with me to honor his father and give the whole float more appeal, and he did. And so we've been doing this together, I guess, for 20 years. I might back up for a second to tell a few things about Peanut Jim that I know otherwise. Since this all kind of started, I would have people, and still today, have people come up to me and tell me stories about him. I was with Philip Paul the other day, who's a mainstay with King Records, as you know, and he was talking about his memories. He and his wife, who grew up in Evanston, but they spent a lot of time playing, Philip Paul playing at the Cotton Club. So there are a lot of memories of the Cotton Club, which was this outstanding nightclub in West End, and all the activity in the neighborhood at that time, including Peanut Jim, recalling that he started as actually a potato skin vendor. He would sell potato skins on the street, and the peanuts actually came later. So that was one of the memories that's been recalled on a couple of occasions. Frank Allison, an early day of sort of icon in West End, had a music store. As a kid, an assistant to Peanut Jim, to selling potato skins. That's how I first found out about it. Also, people come up to me on a fairly regular basis and identify themselves as a cousin or a nephew or a grandnephew or great-great-grandnephew of Peanut Jim. He was a family man, plus plus. I think he had a big family. And what's interesting is that the folks who will come up and introduce themselves as kin of Jim's are always just really sweet people. They're always very gracious and very generous and very enthusiastic about their memory of him and very grateful that someone would choose to represent him this way. Up to and including a niece who called me from Delaware a couple of years ago, and they were having a Peanut Jim reunion. And he's got kin all over the place. And they were having this grand reunion of the extended family from around the country and wanted to know if I would come. I cannot tell you all the wonderful things I've enjoyed in my life. That was right near the top, to be included. Now, it turns out that I could not go because I was otherwise engaged and I couldn't rearrange it. It's one of the saddest days that I missed that reunion because I can only imagine the stories that went down that day or that weekend. And she started telling me who was coming, and there were doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs. They were in a succession of peanut vendors, which would have been fine. But the point is that he really left quite a legacy and quite a family, and it keeps working. Turns out that I don't know if, in fact, he was born in West End or where he might have been before that or his family before that. Most folks from West End in the early days are from the South. They came up to Cincinnati looking for jobs. And I assume that's true for Jim and his family. But he lived on Liberty Street, which was right just a couple blocks from where we're speaking right now. And he was just a few blocks from the ballpark. So he literally kind of rolled out of bed in the morning, went down to the peanut provision house and got his peanuts, and then rolled on down to the ballpark. And one of the reasons, the things that's so important to me, one of the other things about him is what he represents, could represent, hopefully does represent to a lot of kids, particularly in the neighborhood, in this neighborhood, who are maybe born in humble circumstances, maybe don't have all of the mentors, the role models that we might have had, some of us. And what he represents, the fact that he could not read or write, by the way, but he was self-employed, and he bought and owned a lot of real estate and was a one-man band in that respect, collected all his own rents, and did very well. I think he, in relative terms, died a wealthy man. To me, it points up the importance of having job opportunities close to where you live, no matter how humble those opportunities are, just a way to kind of get started, you know, get a little piece of the action. It's one of the things that bothered me about the ballpark moving out of West End, because it represented a lot of job opportunities for kids in the neighborhood. There are all these facets about him. It's not just this handsome man with a top hat that sold peanuts. If you dig a little deeper, the story about him just goes on and on. He's an icon now. He's a celebrity now, perhaps. But I think at that time, people just saw him as a part of the workforce. But I don't know that he did get a key to the city. And it came in a different form. It came in the way of a street name, which is a sad point and something that needs to be addressed still. When the new ballpark was built on the river, there was a walkway between Atrium 2, which is that office building on 4th Street, 4th and Main. There was a walkway from there over the expressway to the new ballpark. And that was named Peanut Jim Shelton Way, which was noteworthy and important. But it's just as noteworthy that it doesn't exist any longer. When they redefined the banks and the riverfront district, it was decided that the walkway over the expressway, well, when the expressway was rebuilt, it didn't work anymore. It had nothing to do with him. Just from a traffic point of view, it didn't work anymore. So they took it down, and it's not been replaced. That ought to be addressed somewhere in the ballpark district especially. And I think there is a recognition of him at the Hall of Fame, the Reds Hall of Fame, which is adjacent to the ballpark.
They definitely had food at the ballpark. The nice thing was that they did allow people to bring food in. And what I've heard, and this story came from my father-in-law, my late father-in-law, who was going to games there in the 30s. If a young man, say 8, 10, 12, 14, could find an adult walking to the ballpark with a ticket, they would let the kid in for free with him. And my father-in-law did that all the time. And that was a beautiful thing because kids could go to games for free. There were streetcars running out there from downtown. A lot of people even walked from downtown. It wasn't that far from downtown. And I think they really attracted young fans at that ballpark. And I love stories about kids getting in for free because obviously those are the future fans.
Bernie Stowe has had a long career with the Reds dating back to 1947. His wife, Priscilla, has a lot of memories.
He was only 12, and they let him work in a clubhouse. And he was only 14 when he became bat boy. And in them days, you had to get permits from the Board of Education. And his mom had 7 kids, and she worked, so she didn't have time for all that kind of stuff. And Gabe Paul was the general manager then, and he took him down to the Board of Education to get his work permit. He was bat boy for a long time because he was kind of slight in build. In them days, they liked the boys to look smaller than the players. He was bat boy till he was, I guess, 20 years old. He went into the clubhouse, worked with Chesty Evans. Chesty Evans was equipment manager then. And we got married, and he was working in the clubhouse. So we needed more money. So he started a delivery service for drugstores. And he did that during the day. And then after he got done, he'd go down and help Chesty. By then, it was usually the game was nearly over. Pretty much, that's when their work really starts. They have to do the laundry and clean the shoes and get everything ready for the next day. And so he worked in the clubhouse. And then Chesty retired at the end of 1967, and he recommended Bernie. By then, Dick Wagner and Bob Howson were there, and Bernie sent a resume in, and they took him. He was the equipment manager until when my youngest son took over. And they changed Bernie's title to senior equipment manager, and Rick's equipment manager, and my other son's the visiting clubhouse manager.
And a hot dog at the game beats roast beef at the Ritz. Well, that's baseball, and it's my game. You know, you take your worries to the park, and you leave them there. You yell like crazy for your guys. Good for your lungs. Gives you a lift, and nobody calls the cops. Pretty girls, lots of them, but not any prettier than Baby. Are you listening, baby?
I met a lad, handsome and witty, who whispered to me, "You are so pretty." Soon he and I were cabareting. We had a good time, goes without saying. He came to my house, all the lights were low, and then he held me close, set my heart aglow. He told me that my lips were as sweet as wine. With that he put his two lips close to mine and talked of baseball, baseball, the Dodgers and baseball, baseball, Stan Musial and baseball, baseball, all through the night, baseball, baseball. I was so mad, I got to thinking, surely this lad will start me drinking, for there was me, eager and healthy, in love with a he. Handsome and wealthy, I tried to get him in my sweet embrace. All he had on his mind was the pen and trace. And though I saw him practically every night, we never went to movies, I saw a fight. We just saw baseball, baseball, DiMaggio and baseball, baseball, Chicago Cubs, baseball, baseball, DeRocher and baseball, baseball. My heart knew such humiliation that I sat and planned retaliation, using the wiles known to all women. I'd marry that man if it was human. The wedding bells rang, we were one in June. Triumphantly we went on our honeymoon. He held me very tight under stars so bright and whispered, "Darling, who do you love tonight?" I told him, "Baseball, baseball, the Tigers and baseball, baseball, Ted Williams and baseball, baseball. I love the game, baseball, Yankees, Red Legs, Braves, White Sox, Indians, Phillies, Senators, Red Sox, Orioles, Athletics, Pirates, baseball, baseball, baseball."
Betty Say is a Reds fan who worked for the team when it was at Crosley Field.
We felt like it was home when we'd go to Crosley Field. We felt very comfortable there, just being teenagers. We didn't have to worry. And in those days, we caught a bus, had to go downtown, and we all took buses to different parts of the city, late at night, even after a ball game. And we just all loved baseball. I grew up with my family listening to the Reds all the time. So I can remember my older sisters taking me to the ballpark on Ladies' Day. You'd sit way out in the bleachers almost, I guess they were. And the fan clubs, you would not believe the players in those days. They would come to our little meetings. We were little high school kids. We would actually carry the food to the picnic on buses to the picnic grounds, and all these ball players and their families would come and have a great time with us. But Crosley Field is very special. We felt at home, and we could all meet. Nobody ever called saying, are you going to the ball game? Because we knew there'd be somebody sitting down on left field that we could sit with. I was working for the agricultural department of the government right after high school. And a lady I worked with, she was one of the managers, she came in and she knew I was a baseball fan. And she came in one day and she said, I heard on the Reds baseball game last night, Wade Hoyt mentioned the Reds are looking for a secretary. Why don't you apply? Which I did. I sent a resume and they called me up and I got the job. But later on, Wade Hoyt, I just got to know Wade Hoyt from being at the ballpark at the office. And he said, he never said that. He said, I would never have promoted something like that on a broadcast. So to this day, I have no idea where this lady heard this, but for some reason, I guess it was meant to be. And I loved it there. 57 to 68, I loved that job. Now, there were only, I believe, 7 women in the office at that time to run the whole ball club. The Reds' office were downtown in the old Union Central Annex. We did not have offices at the ballpark. Now, the men would come to work at 9 o'clock, 5 o'clock, then they'd take the tickets and all the things for the press, and then take it to the ballpark, and they had a general office at Crosley Field. But the main ticket office was downtown. The men would get in their cars and go to Crosley Field, have meals down there with the press. And sometimes they wouldn't get home till probably 11, 12 o'clock by the time they'd get their work all finished. Then they'd be back in the office at 9 o'clock in the morning. Their wives had to really love those men because they were never home. When I first went to work, I worked in the office of the farm director, Bill McKechnie, Jr. One whole wall was a big blackboard, and he actually had wrote in the farm team, wrote in all the players, and he did that all by hand, kept track of the farm system. I had the typewriter that was mechanical, nothing was electric, and we'd have to type these averages on a stencil where you just poked holes in a stencil, and then you put it on a mimeograph, and with a handle, you ran them out. And it was quite time-consuming to do that for every game. And I can remember him talking to some of these young players, and they made very little in the minor leagues. And I remember him yelling at one of the young players saying, you're going to school. We're paying your tuition for school. That's what the farm system is. We're teaching you baseball. We're just giving you enough money to live on. It's not a salary. And I can remember him telling these young players that all the time. You're like an intern, just learning your trade. Young people inside the scoreboard, and they'd have to climb the ladders to put the numbers down. They would slide through, I guess, little holes in the wall, and they'd slide the numbers down. I just remember there was one young man that used to come in the office, and he worked in the scoreboard. So I know they were all young, probably high school kids. And they just have to stay in the scoreboard through the whole game and put the numbers up at the end of an inning, 0 or 2 or 1. And when I was working for the publicity director, and I'd have to type up their averages every day. And he'd bring the score book in, and I would add how many hits somebody got. But I had a little book that lists 1 for 1, 1 for 2, 1 for 3, give your average, and I'd have to type it on a stencil. And we'd run them off on a mimeograph for the newspaper people. And it didn't change on the scoreboard during the game. That same average stayed up there the whole game because you just didn't do it in 2 seconds like it does now. We all had to do the math on it after every game. I still like the older players that were playing when we were really involved with it. Jim Maloney, Ted Kluszewski was one of my favorites. He was a gentle person. He was huge, but he was such a gentle person. And Gus Bell would come in our office all the time, and he was always nice to the girls in the office. One time after I left the Reds, I worked for the National League, and then they moved out west, and I chose not to go. And Pete Rose came in and gave me some names of people that he had talked to about me trying to help me get a job. Even through everything that has gone on with Pete Rose, I still stick up for him all the time. But it was that error with the Big Red Machine and Johnny Bench, and I enjoyed them much, I shouldn't say much more than today's, but naturally I don't have the opportunity to meet them anymore, so now they're players. Before, I thought of them as friends.
Johnny Bench, Tony Perez played there, Lee May played there, famous last game where I think May and maybe Bench hit back-to-back home runs off Marichal, June 24th, 1970. Great finish to a great ballpark. Yeah, I mean, Johnny Bench told me one time, he said he hated the place because it was so old and dank, but I think most people have fond memories of the place because it was so intimate. They obviously loved moving into a new palace in 1970 and then Riverfront Stadium, but boy, there was only one Crosley Field, and I wish it were still around today.
Today, the spirit of Crosley Field lives on in the Cincinnati suburb of Blue Ash. Chuck Funk is the city's Parks and Recreation Director.
Well, our former center manager was a huge Reds fan, grew up in the Cincinnati area, and he's the one that came up with the idea to build a recreated Crosley Field. We completed that process in 1987. Same terrace, so it's terraced going up to the wall. All the dimensions are exactly like Crosley was back in 1970 and even before. There's a quad of fields in that part of the facility. We have 11 fields total, but that quad in the back has Crosley, and then it has the exact dimensions of Riverfront is just to the back of that. So it doesn't have the stadium, obviously, but it does have the walls are pretty much green. Like if you remember the old Riverfront walls, and they're all exact same dimensions. Again, we tried to lay it out as closely as possible to the old park as we could. And Crosley Field, it still has an area out in right field, which is the bleacher seating. So it has the terrace area out there. Everything is pretty much set the exact same location. Same direction, home plate sits in the same direction, everything. A gentleman named Mark Rohr was our assistant city manager before I came to Blue Ash, and he was kind of the guy they put in charge of going out and trying to find as much memorabilia and parts of the field and all those kind of things. And he did a lot of research, ran into some brick walls along the way, but was able to come up with quite a few things, and actually some of the stuff is now with the Reds Hall of Fame, and they're using that in some of their displays that they do around the city. We were able to find a lot of the original seats for the facility, so we still have a lot of those in place. We have one of the old original ticket buildings from that area. A lot of the signage and things like that are still original from Crosley. The scoreboard itself is a recreated version of that last day at Crosley Field. The Reds playing the Giants, so familiar numbers up there, Willie Mays and Willie McCovey from the one side, and of course Bench and Rose, and the beginning of the Big Red Machine. On the back of the grandstand wall, we have plaques, and I don't know how many there are now, but there's probably 75 to 100 plaques from former Reds players, other former Major League players that have come to some of our events out there. So it's a pretty neat idea. When you walk through, you get to see all the old-time players, and each one of them are bronzed, has their number, their name, their kind of their facsimile of each one of those players. We've had several reunions of the Reds since we started the facility in 87. Obviously, most all of the Big Red Machine, Jim Maloney's been there. We did a Nux all day, Pete Rose, of course, Johnny Vandermeer, who is the double no-hitter guy. We actually did one with him, so he's there.
You know, some men pitch a lifetime without a no-hitter. Yet young Johnny Vandermeer of Cincinnati back in 1938 had two in one season. And most incredible of all, he got them in consecutive starts on June the 11th and June the 15th against Boston and Brooklyn.
I was a little nervous and jittery, but I just thought, well, I'll just go as far as I possibly could, and I got in trouble in the last inning, but McKechnie kind of straightened me out. Bill came in there and told me I was pressing, and with the bases full, why, I was lucky enough to get out of it with the help of Lou Riggs making a smart force play at home plate. Well, we went from Brooklyn to Boston, and Debs Garms, an outfielder, got the first base hit off me, a line drive back to the box, and I could have walked over and give him a $10 bill because that foolishness has to quit sooner or later.
You can see it from 275 and the interchange of 71 there, so a lot of people see it, drive out of their way, come down to see the facility. We get folks from all over the country, actually, that come into town and say, hey, I grew up here, I went to games here as a kid, so yeah, we get tons of people.
Reds greats like Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, and Frank Robinson played at Crosley Field. Other baseball icons like Babe Ruth, Mickey Mantle, and Hank Aaron played there too. Crosley Field was torn down in 1972, leaving behind many great memories and launching one of the greatest baseball teams of all times, the World Championship Big Red Machine of the 1970s. You've been listening to Cincinnati Baseball, Crosley Field, produced by Lee Hay with technical support from Rick Andrus and Kevin Rawinski. Thanks also to the Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame, the Rosie Reds, and Mike Martini. I'm your host, Mark Haney.
And until then, this is the old left-hander rounding third and heading for home. Good night, everyone.